I want to begin in the middle of the 19th century, someplace in rural England. We're on horseback. We're approaching a grand house. It looks like a little bit like a small Blenheim. We tie our horse at a rusty gate. We follow a path to the house. We walk up the broad stairs of the terrace, through the great doors, and into a lofty hall with a domed ceiling. We walk through a series of apartments, which are decorated in silks, gilding, and marble, which have been untouched for 200 years. Everything is dusty and faded, and we're heading through all these rooms to the library, of course. Or at least that's what we think. But when we get to the library, we find that there's a hidden door, which is faced with false backs of books. So we walk through that door into an old room, which is older than the house. And it is part, in fact, of the original mansion that stood on this site before the thing that looks like a little Blenheim was constructed. And there's a chimney piece in this room which reaches to the ceiling, and it's decorated with geometrical figures and signs of the zodiac. It holds a plaque in the middle which reads, "In this room, Simon Forman, the seeker of hidden truth, taking refuge from unjust persecution, made those discoveries in nature which he committed for the benefit of a wiser age to paper." And when we see Forman's name, we remember that he was one of the most notorious of those astrologers or soothsayers, and I'm quoting, whom the superstitious of an earlier age alternately persecuted and honored. We have been looking through the eyes of a fictional doctor, one Alan Fenwick, and we are in an imaginary room. I don't have a picture of it because it's an imaginary room. I've just tried to conjure one for you. Fenwick is the protagonist in a novel called A Strange Story, written or published in 1862 by Edward Bulwer Lytton. Now, Bulwer Lytton wrote this novel towards the end of his life, toward the end of his career, and his life, and he, for those of you who don't know, I didn't know about him until recently because I'm not English. He was one of the most widely read novelists of his age, and he had developed an interest in the occult. He studied quite extensively in the occult arts at the end of his life. So A Strange Story is a novel about the inability of science to explain the spiritual or the supernatural. And Forman's papers play a small but critical role in this book. So you get a little bit more of 19th century kind of drama here. So the house containing Forman's old study belonged to one Sir Philip Darrell, who had been murdered, of course. And Fenwick, he is a rational physician, has arrived at Darrell's house to read Darrell's memoir in the hope that the memoir will contain some clues about who the murderer was. So Fenwick sits in Forman's former study reading Darrell's memoir, and in the memoir he learns that Darrell's fascination with the occult was kindled when, as a heartbroken young man retreating from the world, he found Forman's papers wedged in this room. They were damp, they were moth-eaten. And he writes, so this is Fenwick describing these things, obviously in the words of Bulwer Lytton. Some of them were astrological observations and predictions. Some were upon the nature of the Kabbalah. Some upon the invocation of spirits and the magic of the Dark Ages. All had a certain interest, for they were interspersed with personal remarks, anecdotes of eminent actors in a very stirring time. Others, he continues, were treatises of a more uncommon and more startling character. These were discussions on various occult laws of nature and detailed accounts of analytical experiments. These opened a new and practical field of inquiry, a true borderland between natural science and imaginative speculation. So Forman's writings on occult experiments were what inspired Darrell to become, to devote his life to the experimental study of the spiritual realms, But then, towards the end of his life, Derrell had become disillusioned with Foreman and the follies of astrology, and he had decided it was time to burn these papers. But just before he did that, someone killed him. So, Foreman's papers are inspirational, and they turn out to be erroneous, perhaps even dangerous. Fenwick, a man of science, disbelieves them. Of course, Derrell, a student of occult philosophy, wants them destroyed. So Foreman, throughout the last 400 years, has featured in various historical and literary works. And as Bulwer-Lytton says, he's alternatively been persecuted and honored. So now we get to move to another room. This is the library at Hogwarts. I studied there from 1992 to 1996. And what I was doing there was reading Simon Foreman's papers, all 15,000 pages of them, multiple times. In those days, as those of you who giggled know, that was Duke Humphrey's library just across the way there before it was a film set. It is part of the Bodleian Library. It is where one used to read Foreman's manuscripts. And this is where one would have read Foreman's papers for a very long time, not in this hidden room in this country house, as Bulwer-Lytton imagined. Why he imagined this, I don't know, because he's not my topic, but I was quite delighted to find Foreman featuring in that hard book. So how did Foreman's papers get from his study in Lambeth, when he died, to the Bodleian Library? So Foreman died in 1611, as I've said. He left his books and papers to his protege, a man called Richard Napier. These passed through Napier's family through the 17th century and were bought toward the end of the 17th century by Elias Ashmole. Ashmole was the great collector of books and manuscripts. He had a keen interest in astrology, alchemy, natural magic, some ritual magic, and the history of Britain. And his collection has played a major role in shaping how historians understand the history of the occult sciences. His collections also included paintings, antiquities, and curiosities, and he donated his entire archive, minus some things lost in a fire and some other complicated stories, to the University of Oxford in 1677 and founded the Ashmolean Museum there in 1683. This was the first public museum, I believe, others can correct me, in Europe. And in 1860, so several centuries later, the Ashmole collections of books and manuscripts were separated from the other stuff and moved to the Bodleian Library, where they've remained ever since. Now, of course, I found this room an enchanting place to work. And of course, I was captivated by Foreman's papers. These are old handwritten documents bound in huge volumes, big leather calf volumes fastened with brass clasps. Various scholars have described how they're so tightly done up by these clasps, it looks as though the papers are trying to get out on their own. I'm sorry, I don't have a picture of these books. I am negotiating with the Bodleian about this. My pursuit was driven, I like to think, more by intellectual curiosity than antiquarian escapism. Margaret Pelling, my supervisor, is in the room, and she might have words with me later about that. And we could say that Foreman's papers were like a landscape to me. They were a foreign country. They were an exotic land. I've been reading, you know, Bulwer-Lytton, that's all rather florid, but there I was escaping into a series of analytic questions. I had been studying anthropology before I came to study history. And I was interested in questions about rationality and superstition, especially in relationship to medicine and healing. So my starting point was a determination to take magical practices seriously. And My starting point was to say if we call the activities of 20th century African healers or Elizabethan astrologers magical, if that is the label that we're going to use, or if we want to call them superstitious, or if we want to use quackery, this word, what we do is we fail to take the logic of this work seriously. And that's the lot failing to take it seriously for either the practitioners or their clients. So to frame questions about healing in terms of belief was my contention. My contention was that, and as I've subsequently formulated it more clearly, was to participate in arguments about superstition which have been used to denigrate occult practitioners at least since the 16th century and quite probably in different sorts of ways since classical antiquity. So these are arguments which denigrate occult practitioners by saying that what they're doing is superstitious. These are arguments which are actually arguments about credulity and incredulity. They're arguments about plausibility and implausibility, about whether astrology works, about who understands the mysteries of the universe, about whether this knowledge is powerful, and about how and why it should be used. So in short, questions about rationality and superstition themselves need to be understood as historical problems. These are not absolutes. What is superstition and what is rational has itself a long history. And much of that history is rooted in the 16th century. So many early modern people knew this, and many modern people do not. I knew it from reading philosophers of science. I could have learned it if I'd read some Victorian spiritualists. I didn't. So who is this man whose eyes I was going to see the world, this world that teemed with spirits? Who was this man whose eyes I was going to borrow? It was a strange thing to embark on. This is Simon Forman. He was a notorious quack. This is why he would have been remembered, if he was going to have been remembered at all, if he hadn't written so much about himself, about the study of the occult arts, and about his practices as an astrologer physician. So he wrote autobiographies which tell the story of his early life. He was born in Quidhampton, Wiltshire, which is outside Salisbury, to a family stripped of its entitlement with the dissolution of the monasteries. Forman had a passion for learning, but his resentful mother held him back. He had women issues, as you'll see. Some years at a grammar school and an apprenticeship to a hosier and brochure in Salisbury came to an end when he quarreled with his master's wife. He spent 18 months in Oxford as a poor scholar in 1573-4, but was distracted by his studies, from his studies, by the amount of time he had to spend attending the frivolous gentlemen who employed him while they chased women. And we then don't know very much about the middle decades of his life. He worked as a school teacher, he practiced medicine, he learned astrology, he began to study alchemy and various nefarious arts, and he was often in trouble with the law. He traveled abroad a couple times. He says he was once captured by pirates. In the early 1590s, he moved to London and his fortunes changed. He tried and failed to win the favor of the community of merchants and navigators in the city, but when the plague arrived in 1592, he caught it. He cured himself wondrously with a special strong water that he happened to have made in advance. And that was the turning point in his reputation, because financial security brought him new enemies, and a new set of documents were then written by him. He began to keep astrological diaries in order to chart the trials in his life and his success and often failure at overcoming this adversity. The College of Physicians of London rebuked him. This is the body responsible for regulating the practice of medicine in the city. And he scorned them. And this was an enmity that would last for the rest of his life. Now, despite the efforts of the medical establishment, Fulman established a thriving astrological practice. His casebooks survive from 1596 to 1603, and these contain up to 2,000 records a year. They document the intimate details about the health, fortunes, and romantic activities of numerous Londoners. Some of the most vivid accounts are about himself. He cast charts to know when his health would improve, to determine the best time to send letters to patrons and visit friends, and to locate his missing garters and stolen books. He dreamed that he offered to impregnate the Queen to stop her skirts from dragging in the muddy London streets, and he wrote the dream down in his notebooks. He devoted himself to the study of the medical, occult, and related arts, and he produced thousands of pages of guides to astrology, compendia of alchemy, histories of creation, and related works. He took these subjects very seriously, and he produced an astonishingly rich repository of Elizabethan manuscript culture. Now, as Fulman became professionally secure, he decided to establish a family. He was no stranger to romance, and he had already fathered at least one son, but this was something new, and he sought a wife. It was like a project for him. You can see it in action. And he began to assemble family histories so that his heirs would then slot in. And in 1599, at the age of 46, he married a woman called Anne, or sometimes called Jean Baker. She was 16. She was from a good family. He called her Tronco, which we think means body. From this date, Fulman lived in Lambeth, and he continued to practice astrology. He honed his expertise. He resisted the meddling of the College of Physicians. He managed his orchard. He cultivated an interest in genealogy, and he hoped for children. Dorothy was born in 1605, but she lived only a few months. But then Clement was born the following year and lived to be an adult. So this is how Fulman spent the final decade of his life, as a comfortable family man in Lambeth, holding his enemies at bay, and occasionally visiting the theatre and dabbling in court intrigue. He continued to write, and towards the end of his life, he recorded eyewitness accounts, often thought to be forgeries, I don't think they are, of some of Shakespeare's plays, that's Macbeth, Cymbeline, and The Winter's Tale, in the same mode at which he recorded accounts of histories. In September of 1611, he predicted his own death. It's a good story, but I'm not going to tell it again now. And we don't, funnily enough, actually know when he died. We know everything about this man, but not when he died. We know he was buried. That was on the 12th of September, but there's a gap in the records. But after his death, he was implicated in the Overbury scandal, which was a series of trials surrounding the poisoning of Sir Thomas Overbury, in which what we can call the popular press exposed sordid details about court intrigue. Fulman was alleged to have provided Frances Howard, the Countess of Essex, and her friend Anne Turner with magical means of estranging Howard's husband, who was Robert Devereux, and winning the affections of the king's favorite, erstwhile favorite, Robert Carr. And Overbury ends up dead, and it's all a mess. Mm-hmm. So, since then, since the Overbury affair, Fulman has been variously reviled as a quack, as an agent of the devil, as a womanizer, or lauded as a pioneering astrologer and a voice of his age. He was a nasty little man. And he and I have a very complicated relationship. So through his papers, I recovered his daily pursuits, or the daily pursuits of medicine and magic by Elizabethan and Jacobean Londoners. And this required me to cross some conventional disciplinary boundaries, blending history of science and the history of medicine, and handling astrology, alchemy, and various forms of magic in equal parts. I wrote this book that finally came out in 2005, which sets, sort of recasts some historical questions about science and magic, about learned and artisanal knowledge. It asks some questions about gender and the dynamics of healing, about manuscript and print culture, and about the medical marketplace. Foreman's papers. I let Foreman's papers dictate which questions were posed and how they were answered. And Foreman shows us, from the perspective of his desk in Elizabethan London and Jacobean Lambeth, more or less, what it meant to pursue esoteric arts and how arcane expertise was used. So now we move to my third room, which is Foreman's study. This is not Foreman's study, but it is an image of a woman consulting an astrologer. This is not Foreman's study, but it's another image of a woman consulting an astrologer. You're getting the idea. I don't have a picture of Foreman's study. This is a picture of a man consulting an astrologer, and I apologize to those of you who've heard me use this example before, but it does what I need it to do, and I will continue to use it. This is a woodblock illustration of the title page of a 1620 anti-astrological work by John Melton. It's called Astrologaster or the Figure Caster. And Melton describes the scene that the picture depicts. Before a square table, covered with a green carpet, on which lay a huge book in folio, wide open, full of strange characters such as the Egyptians and Chaldeans were never guilty of. Not far from that, a silver wand, a surplus, a watering pot, with all the superstitious or rather feigned instruments of his cousin in art. And to put a fairer color on his black and foul science, on his head he had a four-cornered cap, on his back a fair gown, but made in a strange fashion. In his right hand he held an astrolabe, in his left a mathematical glass. But the scene, this is why Melton is so beautiful, the scene extends beyond the consulting room. We find the astrologer, Melton tells us, by following a gaggle of women down the back streets of London to the house of the astrologer. And once you get there, you can ask, if you pay enough money, the whereabouts of lost money, silver, spoons, rings, gowns, plate, or linen, how many children you would have, how many husbands, and which would love you best. In exchange for your money, you can get many words of little value. So Melton criticizes the astrologer for professing what he calls an absolute and exquisite knowledge in philosophy, astronomy, physics, metaphysics, the mathematics, and astrology, while really, Melton says, he's a mountebank who deludes his clients. These are creatures who are so ignorantly obstinate that they would not hear a word against the astrologer. Now, this image echoes a passage in the Elizabethan Faust book. This is for the English Faust book, published in 1592. Here we have Faustus, and I quote, accompanied himself with divers that were seen in the devilish arts, and that had the Chaldean, Persian, Hebrew, Arabian, and Greek tongues, using figures, characters, conjurations, incantations, with many other ceremonies belonging to the infernal arts, insomuch that he waxed a worldly man, and named himself an astrologian, and a mathematician, and sometimes a physician. So Melton is describing an English Faust. That's what he is portraying, how he is, what he wants to resonate with his description of the astrologer. Astrologers, despite their dubious learning and empty results, attract a steady and devoted clientele. And Melton is trying to explain this. He characterizes the astrologer, I want you to note, as fraudulent, not as demonic. Now, there were three ways that early modern people explained the occult arts. They were natural. This is just the way it is. The stars affect life on Earth, the way the moon affects the tides. They were the actions of the devil, or they were worked by fraud and trickery. And one of the things to remember is that the devil often works through illusions, and he makes people believe that what he is doing is natural. So the categories get mixed up. So Milton's evocative book seeks to explain the popularity of astrologers in terms of the credulity and incredulity of their clients, and also in terms of what we might call the charisma of the astrologer. Stephen and I were joking that the image of Foreman on the poster outside has drawn you all in. Milton begins with an astrologer called P.C. Moorfields. I haven't worked out who this is, but he later compares him with several other figures. The cunning man on the bankside, Mother Broughton in Chick Lane, young Master Olive in Turnbull Street, the shag-haired wizard in Pepper Alley, these were supposed to be real people, the surgeon with the bagpipe cheek, and Dr. Foreman in Lambeth. And this is the beginning of a period when the English are perceiving a plague of astrologers and related practitioners. So in 1631, we have a clergyman called William Foster, he's a Buckinghamshire man, who's complaining that the practice of using the weapon salve is taking over the country. I won't explain the weapon salve to you now, later if you like. And thanks to the work of Margaret Pelling, we have a sense of how many medical practitioners are at work in England, from roughly 1500 to 1640, and we have a sense of how medicine fitted into the model of occupational diversity. It was practiced alongside other skills. But we don't yet have a full understanding of how many of these practitioners used astrology, alchemy, magic, and related arts. Now, Margaret, I refer to her by first name because she's there, highly embarrassed, has identified 6 astrologers and 6 magician, sorcerers, wizards who came to the attention of the College of Physicians for practicing medicine in London between 1550 and 1640. It's not very many. And such characters were prominent enough for the great provincial demonologist, Reginald Scott, in his 1584 Discovery of Witchcraft, to reflect that astrologers attracted enough clients not to starve of hunger. So it's unclear, it's genuinely unclear, I think, whether the notoriety of a few practitioners represents the activities of many, or whether their reputations loomed large in the popular imagination. What is clear is that the debates about superstition and credulity crystallize in the portrayals of the astrologers. Foreman often plays this role. He plays this role from Ben Jonson's Devil is an Ass, staged in 1616, through Nathaniel Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter, published in 1850. We've already seen that he numbers amongst the back alley astrologers that Milton names in his 1620 work. And quills and papers are often Foreman's props. Maybe because his papers, along with various magical objects, lewd wax images, get the picture in your head again, I don't have a picture, sorry, featured in evidence of the trials of the Overbury scandal. And one account around the Overbury scandal describes Foreman as the fiend in human shape that by his art did act the devil's ape, poring over his blasphemous books, making strange characters in blood-red lines. He often wrote in red ink, not blood red, but, you know, red ink. If we could see into Foreman's study, would we find him posed with a staff in hand amidst chalk circles on the floor summoning demons? He occasionally did this. It's rather scary. But he wasn't pure enough of body or soul to succeed in conjuring more than a sort of whiff of brimstone. So if, in an ordinary, what's today? Tuesday? Say, with morning time, that's a more regular time. So in ordinary Tuesday morning, we wandered into Foreman's study, we'd probably find him at his desk. And he would be surrounded by books and papers, and there would be these great heaps of loose papers covered in his crabbed hand, because that's how he kept his papers. He didn't have them bound into notebooks. They're just big folded sheets written all over in not any particularly good order. So during the course of his life, as I've said, he filled 15,000 pages with notes and writings. It was Ashmole who had these bound into these big volumes, they fill 40 of them roughly, a handful of items made it into other collections, and Forman is one of the people best represented in the Ashmore collection. One of the paradoxes about Forman is that while he wrote constantly, he failed to methodize his own papers, and he was not really interested in print. He was working within a manuscript tradition. He copied texts, he compiled notebooks, he wrote around 15 treatises. And there are five topics around which his papers coalesce. There are his accounts of his own life. There are astrological notes and writings. There are alchemical commonplace books and transcriptions of more than 100 alchemical texts. There are works on magical themes, mostly copied by him, some written a little bit. And then there are these works which I lump together as sort of history and cosmology, which include everything from a treatise on the life of Adam and Eve, which he copied out, to some notes on the history of giants. And I would lump the accounts of Shakespeare's plays in there as well. The history of knowledge, particularly the knowledge of health and disease, is one of the recurring themes throughout all of these papers. Now, many of Forman's papers are remarkable, but one set stands out, and these are his casebooks. These survive, as I think I've already said, from 1596 to 1603, and they document up to 2,000 consultations a year. Forman is probably the most popular astrologer in Elizabethan London, and his papers are the reason why we are imagining ourselves in his study. The other papers are interesting. The fact that Forman sat at his desk writing day after day is interesting, but the traffic through his front door and the fact that he assiduously wrote down what happened in the consultations with the people who came to see him is exceptional. Forman systematically recorded 10,000 astrological consultations in this 6-year period. So here is, finally you get to see a Forman manuscript. This is a page of the case books. If you really want to know what it says, there's a transcription. But I haven't transcribed the figure in the middle. I'm not going to take you through any particular case. I'm going to give you a general account. So an astrologer would call on, a client would call on the astrologer at home in his study or send a message. And the astrologer systematically wrote down the following details. Person's name, often Big Thomas Eliot. I tried to make it big in my copy of it. Name, age, whether the person appears in person or sends a letter or messenger, the question posed, always the moment at which the consultation began or the message arrived, so the notebooks are chronologically ordered. This is orary astrology. The chart or figure is cast for the moment at which the question is asked. Not in modern astrology, as in modern astrology, typically for the time of birth. These are not nativities. He did those too, but that's a smaller part of his practice, and he has separate notebooks for that. And below this, the astrologer would draw a figure, a chart, mapping the positions of the stars at the moment at which the question was asked, and then below that, he recorded his judgment, and in some cases, a prediction, remedy, or recommended course of action. So Forman taught his practices to Richard Napier, who is this rector of Great Linford, Buckinghamshire, to whom he'd left his papers. Napier's records, following Forman's methods, survived from 1599 to 1634. These document an additional 40,000 cases, more or less following Forman's system. And so together we have 14,000 pages in 64 volumes, again, in negotiation with the body and for a picture of the stack of these volumes. They have about 50,000 consultations in them. We don't actually know how many, because until we have edited the Napier, we don't know that they're there. So I've just revealed, we're editing these things. So this is probably, I'll tell you more about that in a second, this is probably the richest surviving set of medical records before 1700. Probably the date can be pushed back a century. The scope of this material is matched by its inaccessibility. They are astrological records written in messy handwriting. The handwriting isn't really the problem, though Napier is a complete and absolute slob. The problem is the astrological notation, which isn't about symbols coding things. It's that everything written in these is ambiguous in terms of whether it is something which the astrologer has divined through the stars or knows from the person in front of him. So this is where I digress and tell you a little bit about this editing project. Right now, as well as marking the 400th anniversary of Forman's death, this month we've also launched, well, we did it in August, but it counts as this month, this project to prepare a critical edition of Forman's and Napier's casebooks. That's a sort of screenshot. And if I have a full screen, if you scroll down, you see that I would credit the Wellcome Trust for funding this project and the Bodleian for being a partner in it. And what the project does is it marries scholarly editing with cutting-edge digital humanities. So I run the project. It's supported by Mike Hawkins, who's the technical director, and Rob Rally and John Young as research associates. They all have PhDs in early modern history of science and medicine, and they know the technical stuff too. This is a genuinely hybrid project. The full edition of Forman's records will be mounted in December, and Napier's records should follow by 2013. When it's completed, we will have transcribed and edited what we think is going to be about a million words of text, with about 10 times that much, no, more than 10 times, no, about 10 times that much in metadata. And we think we're supposed to sort of say, because it's digital so you can't see it, it becomes invisible, this is the equivalent of a 10-volume critical edition. But it will be digital. And that means that people can use it to understand this material and to navigate it as never before. This is not linear text that you can simply read. That's why there's so much metadata, that everything has layers and layers of database underneath it, so that you can pull out all Alice Smiths and track her across the records. You can pull out all 15-year-old girls, women, and track them, look at them as a cohort. You can do it geographically. You can see this stuff as from afar. So my interest in these records, if I put on a sort of more straightforward history and medicine hat, is that they show us about the patient-practitioner dynamic, both in terms of how medicine was enacted, what happens between the astrologer and the client, patient and the practitioner, and they show us the way that written records feature in this process. All the astrologers that I might have shown you have books on the desk. They all write and point. The reason Forman and Napier's casebooks are so extraordinary is that medical practitioners did not necessarily keep written records, certainly not before 1550, and because even then, for them to conduct a consultation with a pen in hand and to write things down in a systematic fashion was the exception, not the norm. So if we put it in very grand terms, medical records at any point present us with methodological problems and conceptual problems. Methodologically, how do we see patients, wherever these people are, and their experiences of illness and healing? Are we looking for lost voices? If we're looking for lost voices, are we looking for gendered voices? Are there differences between how women experience healing and how men experience healing, and the differences across age, and whatever other variables we want to come up with? And conceptually, when we search for the patient, again, whoever this is, if we're looking at case books, What is the object of the inquiry? What is that patient, person that we're looking for? Are we looking for a body? Are we looking for a healthy body, a diseased body? Are we looking for a body that we think is a natural entity, or is it a social entity? Are we looking for some kind of subjectivity? And that brings us straight into the problem of what is a patient? Is it a sufferer? Is it a client? And do, ultimately, the conventions of keeping written records reflect or contribute to or shape ideas about health and healing? I don't have answers to any of these questions yet. Actually, I don't think Mrs. Bain having clear answers to any of these questions. We are exploring them. But these are questions that the case books prompt us to ask. So what's in them? Right, I've shown you one. These are Foreman's records. So we have a list of what's in the volumes, the dates. They include the facts that I'm going to throw at you are all written behind me. They include 10,069 consultations. Of these, 455 were put by the astrologer himself, so we take those out of the cohort, but we will come back to them in a minute. And this means that Foreman was asked 9,614 questions over a roughly 6-year period. 90% of these are medical, but that's a conglomerate category. 85% are about things that we would call, I'm going to use Foreman's categories, disease, with another 5% being about pregnancy, will I live or die, how's the childbirth going to go, what should my treatment be, what's my life expectancy, problems with my menstrual cycle. Those are not straightforwardly questions about disease. And in fact, pregnancy, childbirth, and menstruation need some careful scrutiny. And they feed into, everything's all joined up in my world right now, they feed into a big collaborative project on generation to reproduction, which I'm running with many colleagues in Cambridge. So there were little postcards that went around about that that had the casebook's URL on the back, but that's why there's a generation postcard going around as well. 75% of the questions that Foreman was asked were posed by people asking about their own health. And of these, 60% were by women, 40% by men. So that's 4,204 questions by women. My figures might be slightly off because we keep messing with the data. Of these, about 6% we're asking women's health-related questions. That is, they're asking specifically, was a woman pregnant, or were they relating pregnancy to disease? So for women who consulted the astrologer multiple times, and or whose family and friends also asked questions, a profile of health and illness, and details about the practices of consulting the astrologer can be constructive. And these cases are likely to be especially useful in assessing how Foreman, and maybe as well, when we get to him, tied, or if they tied, a woman's health to her reproductive capacity. Were women defined medically and socially by their reproductive capacity? It's a question that historians of gender are particularly interested in. So 70 of Foreman's women clients consulted him 5 times or more across this 6-year period. You can see him can use the source to hone in on certain things. And we could look, we could do more subtle analysis to provide data about the age profile of these women. We could ask whether consulting the astrologer whether they're consulting the astrologer as a matter of course, or because they're trying to control their fertility. We don't know yet. Impressionistically, I can say that in some cases the astrologer was consulted as a source of information. Was a woman pregnant? She would ask. Was the child a boy or a girl? These are standard divinatory questions. In other cases, it's clear that the astrologer was consulted when a woman was having trouble conceiving, or when a couple was having trouble conceiving, usually. And it may be that the astrologer was also consulted in cases of unwanted pregnancy. In his guides to astrological physic, which act as a complement to the casebooks themselves, Buckley, he tells us in manuals how to do it, as well as showing us how he did it in practice. In the manuals, he intimates that women complaining of irregular periods were in fact seeking remedies that would promote menstruation. If you're menstruating, you're not pregnant. So what my work on Foreman's casebook has focused on is his medical practices. And I have explored the dynamics between Foreman and his women clients in particular, and argued, prompted by him, that he used his skills as an astrologer to encourage these women to talk to him about their sexual activities, thereby initiating a form of trust which, in Foreman's view, was integral to good medicine. In the movie, Woody Allen plays Foreman. But in general, what I've done is shy away from the sexual details and the social intrigue recorded in Foreman's casebooks. This has been the focus of A.L. Rouse's 1974 aptly titled book on Foreman, Sex and Society in Shakespeare's Age. But because we're celebrating Foreman this month, I'm going to indulge him, and perhaps you, a bit over the next few minutes. It's not, we don't need to change the rating, don't worry, don't think. But we're going to say, what is in the case books other than questions about headaches and mispriods, right? 10% of these records, it's not a small number, are about other things. So, Rob Rowley and John Young have been transcribing Foreman's records for the past year or so. And they come into my office and they're just abuzz with what they found. Was it really a turd on a spattle that woman was carrying when she came out of the house? None of us know what to do with that. Yes, we've checked the transcription. She came out of the house carrying a turd on a spattle. These are evocative records. They are amusing records. They're sometimes raunchy. They contain questions about hidden treasure and the Philosopher's Stone. They contain questions about a dog that's gone missing. It was wearing a blue velvet collar. Long, long detailed case. They contain cases about supernatural occurrences. Did crickets heard one evening in London portend evil? Was a child, was the child of a couple a changeling? Why was a woman followed by crows? They contain questions about life and death. Was Roland Powell going to kill Wassail Wedlin? Or possibly Wassail Wedlin? I don't know. They contain a lot of information about relationships between men and women. A man asks a question about his wife, who sadly does not love him. Susan Sanders wants to know whether she shall, I quote, live to enjoy him that doth best deserve her. Mr. Green wants to know if it's true that his wife got drunk. Samuel Grubiter's wife and mother, in separate questions, asked whether he had the pox. Ellen Flowers asks whether her husband, he's a sailor, where he is. And then she has sex with Foreman. We know this because Foreman wrote that down too, coded with the word halic. This is this sort of invented word of his, and not an uncommon word in these records. Less anecdotally and more systematically, the edition allows us a bird's eye view of the records. So as I said, 90% of them are what we're going to call non-medical. 90% are medical, 10% are non-medical. We've classified these under 51 headings, and we've attempted to categorize the records according to what we could think of as natural kinds. That is, we're following Foreman's language. There's a glossary to this. It's one of my favorite parts of the project website. It's extremely revealing about life in Foreman's household and Elizabethan London, and I've had various people write to me and say, I had no idea stalking was an early modern preoccupation. We need one word that describes when somebody's asking a question to try and find out whether that woman is going to be there at that time so that he can run into her. Mm-hmm. Stalking. But some of them are more clearly Foreman's categories that he would often write. live or die? That is the question that the person asked. So the majority of these relate to love and marriage, pregnancy, absent persons, live or die, journeys, finance and property, loss and theft, and fortune. And you can see how granular it becomes as you go down the list. And some questions are for multiple things. And this is why this is not straightforward transcription. It's one of the reasons why this is not straightforward transcription. Everything has to be classified systematically. Finally, I want to draw your attention, because this is Foreman Fest, to his most devoted friend, who is, of course, himself. So he asked himself, he consulted the stars 455 times across a 5-year period. The records for 1603 are slightly complicated. There are no questions about him in there. And there's more information about his life details in his other papers, but this is just in the case books. So in, for instance, September 1597, he asked 4 questions about love and marriage, 4 questions about whether to visit his new friend Napier in Buckinghamshire, and 4 questions about treasure, property, monetary things. In April of 1598, he asked 7 questions about love and marriage. Remember, 1599, he finally sorts out, finds a wife, but he's been doing the project up to then. And he asked 5 questions in again, spring 1598, about trouble with the College of Physicians, and 1 about a very special magical object. So, huge variety here, and I should probably give you the slide that I made to show you that list. The chart doesn't really do it for you, it doesn't add much, I think. The categories, I should have just listed them straight as I did in the last slide. So he's got 576 topics because he often did them in batches. 455 questions, 576 topics, and much of it is about romance, visits and journeys, matters legal and financial, and these are scores of questions each, and medical. He asked 35 roughly medical questions for his own health. His occult interests are represented. We get alchemy, we get 15 dreams recorded, and we get a range of astrological techniques. He's particularly creative. He uses the full range of his skills when asking questions about himself. So what does this tell us about the plausibility of astrology? The fact that he is using it, does it tell us that Foreman was not a quack? He believes it, he uses it, but that he's a fool? Well, obviously I'm not going to concede that. It tells us that he lived by his art. That's what he was doing. And it suggests that probably, even though I've taken his work very seriously, I could have looked a little bit more at the intricacies of where he fits in his activities, but I didn't want to be writing a biography. I didn't really like him. I still don't like him. But by studying his practices, what he's doing, whether it's healing or pursuing the Philosopher's Stone or writing, which he spent a huge amount of time doing, we get the distinctions between what we might think of as ideas and practices. Thinking and working collapse. And I find that very, very interesting. So Foreman was my perfect companion for studying practical knowledge and for understanding what I like to call the economy of magic in early modern England. And I have just a few more words after that slightly sulky bit. Am I echoing? I structured this talk around libraries, right? These are places where people keep books and read them. I began with Foreman's study as imagined by Bulwer Lytton as a place where superstition encountered science. And I've ended with Foreman's study as seen through his casebooks. And in the middle I showed you Duke Humphrey's library, which is the place where I got to know Foreman and which will always be, I mean, people are choked up, a kind of intellectual home. And one of the serious lessons of Foreman's papers is that written technologies matter. And as I'm embarking on this massive digital project, I think we need to remember that. Thank you.